Wisconsin has steadily lost dairy farms for decades. We're exploring the impact on the Amish community's dairy herds here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin has about 6,700 dairy farms, the most of any state, but we've also led the nation in recent years in the number of dairy farm bankruptcies. How does this affect the Plain community and their farming operations around Wisconsin? Join in with your questions about Amish settlements and dairy operations, 800-642-1234. John Cross is Professor Emeritus in the Geography Department at UW-Oshkosh. His article on the Amish and the dairy industry was published earlier this year in the Journal of Plain Anabaptist Communities. John, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, start us out with a geography lesson, if you will. Tell us where Amish settlements are located in Wisconsin.
Well, there are actually 62 Amish settlements currently in Wisconsin. We're growing considerably. And in fact, if you think back to 1960, we only had two. We now have 62. The two largest communities are the Cashton community, which covers portions of both Monroe as well as Vernon counties in the western part of the state. The second largest community is the Kingston community, which covers portions of Green Lake, Marquette, and Columbia County. And while those are the two largest, the largest grouping of Amish settlements is in Clark County, where there are six or seven settlements. There are also newer settlements in the area of Grant County, expanding into Lafayette County. They're scattered primarily in the western third of the state. Although, as I said, we had the Kingston community, we have the Watoma community, and there are several, we have the Bondawell community, and then there are several smaller communities in the area, primarily of Manitowoc County.
Yeah.
But those are very small, but it's mostly in the western third of the state.
I think I was most familiar with the Cashton community and particularly its relationship to providing milk for a cheese factory in the area. Is dairy pretty strong in the Cashton community?
Yes, it is, although as with many of the Amish areas of Wisconsin, it is of less significance now than it was. The proportion of the households who are engaged in dairying throughout most of the state has been decreasing. And in fact, there are several Amish settlements in Wisconsin which have never been involved in dairying, but the vast majority are involved in dairying. You mentioned the Cashton community with the cheese factory. The cheese factory originally was built by the Amish to guarantee a place where they could be selling their milk.
How have Amish dairy farmers been doing in recent years, particularly as we see so many dairy herds being sold off, farms going into bankruptcy? How is this affecting the Amish dairy farmers?
Well, it's interesting. The total number of Amish dairy farms in Wisconsin was steadily increasing throughout the past decade. In fact, it's been steadily increasing for a number of decades and reached its highest point around April of 2018, at which time there were 1,160 Amish dairy herds in Wisconsin. Now, when we think of dairy herds, people think of cows. Mm-hmm. Well, 957 of those herds were cows, but 201 of them were herds of milk goats. And then there were a couple herds of sheep. So the Amish have been heavily involved. Now, since 2018, the number of Amish dairy herds has fallen quite precipitously. By April of this current year, the number was down to 939. So you can see in a period of literally in 3 years, we've gone from 1,160 to 939. And it looks like we have lost another probably 20 or so since April of this current year.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with John Cross of UW Oshkosh about the struggles of Amish dairy farmers. And John Cross is a professor emeritus in the university's geography department. You can join in 800-642-1234. Let's go to Jeff in Delafield. Jeff, hi.
Yes, good morning. Quick question, with the Amish farmers, were they able to take advantage of some of the special COVID relief programs offering low interest loans for minority farmers at all? Thank you.
Jeff, thank you. Yeah, Jeff wondering, how the pandemic has affected.
I do not have data on that. However, the Amish typically do not take money from the government. They do not participate in Social Security. They are not involved in crop insurance. So I would speculate that they were not involved in that. I also should comment, the Amish, when they're producing milk, there are two separate groups. There are some who produce grade A milk, like the vast majority of the dairy farmers in the state. Grade A milk can be used for any purpose. However, there are over 400 of the Amish, in fact, the last number of each is slightly over 400, which produce grade B can milk. This is milk that is stored and transported in 10-gallon cans. That milk is not covered under the normal price controls, which would have, there are minimum prices for grade A milk. There is no minimum floor set for grade B milk. Grade B milk can only be used for manufacturing purposes, which is usually cheese manufacturing. And the earlier comment, the question regarding the Cashton community, they built their cheese factory because they were producing canned milk and they needed a market for their cheese. And so when we think about the impact of the current situation on Amish dairying, it is the grade B producers who are most vulnerable. In fact, if we go back literally let's just go back to January of 2018, we had 594 producers of canned milk in Wisconsin. And as of October 1st of this year, we have 409.
So many Amish dairy farms use milk cans to distribute their milk. Some manufacturers now refuse to accept milk that way. Why do some Amish farmers use cans?
To utilize the bulk tank requires the use of technologies which for many Amish settlements run contrary to their religious beliefs. The Amish settlements are governed by a code of conduct. They refer to it as the Ordnung. It is typically unwritten and it is interpreted and implemented by the local bishop. And the behaviors that are considered acceptable do not include the use of electricity from the grid. And so the refrigeration of the milk and the constant agitation, which are all requirements for grade A milk, can't be met by the Amish communities that do not utilize these certain technologies. When you deal with the Amish settlements, they're not all following the same ordnung or same code of conduct. The strictest rules would be in the settlements which use canned milk.
I see.
The less restrictive are going to be in settlements which permit some technology. And I might comment, in some of the settlements which produce grade A milk. Yes, they're not using electricity from the grid, but there may be a generator in the barn.
Let's pause.
And that is acceptable in those communities.
Yeah, let's pause there with UW Oshkosh's John Cross, who studies occupational patterns of Amish settlements in Wisconsin, has data on the dairy industry. What do you want to know about dairy farm operations and a traditional way of life? Does your local cheese factory rely on milk from Amish farmers? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute with John Cross here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the dairy industry through the lens of the Amish community and how dairying is in decline, which reflects broader trends. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Between the spring of 2018 and late fall of 2019, Wisconsin lost 165 Amish dairy herds, and losses are continuing, according to research by UW Oshkosh Professor Emeritus John Cross, who studies these occupational trends in Amish settlements. Are you a farmer? What can you say about the changes to the dairy industry and the ripple effect on Amish dairy farm operations? Join in 800-642-1234. John Cross with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's take a call now. Carrie joining us from West Bend. Hi, Carrie. What would you like to ask?
Good morning. I'm loving this program. I live in an area that's surrounded by CAFOs, and I refuse to buy milk that's not grass-fed. So I would much love to buy Amish products, and I wonder if there is a market for them that isn't necessarily grade A.
John?
Well, the Amish-operated cheese factories are obviously not using grade A milk. I might comment, however, the Amish are also heavily involved in organic production. And this is particularly true in areas of Southwest and West Central Wisconsin. But if you think about the cheese factories that are operated in the Cashton community, it's actually a little rural cheese factory about 7 miles to the south of Cashton. There is a cheese factory that's operated by the Amish near a little south of Kingston. Mm-hmm. Those are all using canned milk. They're not using grade A milk. There is a large cheese cooperative, and while the cooperative is not Amish, they cater to a large number of Amish producers in the southern part of Clark County. And so the products from those cheese factories are not going to be from grade A milk.
The Amish had a major role in establishing the Organic Valley Cooperative. Can you tell us about that?
They were heavily involved in the original. I have seen some statistics, not from research that I have done, but some statistics that at least at one time, when you consider the operations of that cooperative, not just in Wisconsin, but much more broadly, Amish, as well as other old orders, and that would include some old order Mennonites, would comprise about 40% of those who were part of the co-op.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you go about gathering occupational data on the Amish community, and specifically how you go about gathering this data on dairy farming?
Well, I should make a comment. The Amish, not only here in Wisconsin, but in settlements throughout the country, do publish directories. They're published primarily for internal use, but they typically provide information regarding each household and the occupation of that household. It doesn't say that they're involved in dairying. However, if an individual is selling milk, and this is not only true here in Wisconsin, but it's true in other states, they are required to have a license. Those originally were largely set up for health reasons, and the license data is part public record. And so comparing, looking at the licenses, It's fairly easy to identify which of the license holders are Amish and which ones are not.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that license data is available continuously. So literally a person can check the data. Now, if I was to receive the license data, it would take me several weeks to go through it all and sort out who would be Amish and who would not be. But the data can be fairly, you know, precisely defined as a such and such of a time we have so many Amish.
You also looked at comments from Amish ministers who had talked about, you know, the low milk prices and the higher expenses. And
right. I had done a survey among the Amish a few years ago.
Yeah. And that survey also revealed that, you know, a cheese factory trying to get rid of us, and in comments that you could find that these farmers were really struggling with the industry and also how they were being treated within the industry. Can you speak to that?
There are several reasons that some of the cheese factories have concerns about Amish milk. One of the concerns is that the Amish dairy herds are typically small. A producer of canned milk probably has 12 to 14 cows. That's not producing a very large amount of milk. And for some of the large milk buyers, that's not a very convenient amount to come by and to pick up.
Mm.
The Amish likewise do not permit their milk to be picked up on Sundays, which creates some issues for certain milk buyers. And so I think it's the convenience factor, or the inconvenience, maybe we could say, which has caused some of the milk buyers, and I'm talking about those who are taking it to the factory and so forth, to try to avoid some of the Amish producers.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the challenges facing Amish dairy farmers with Professor John Cross. He's a professor emeritus with UW Oshkosh. You can join in 800-642-1234. John, when lockdowns occurred early in the pandemic, we saw dairy farmers were seen dumping their milk into pasture ponds. What happened to Amish dairy farmers?
Well, those who were dumping were not Amish.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a whole series of things which led to the publicized dumping. Basically, those were producers of milk whose ultimate buyers were having problems obtaining the milk. Other words, if your milk processing facility was shipping their milk just to schools, which were closed, they had milk coming in and they had no way of distributing it. The Amish aren't involved in that type of milk production or production for that type of consumption. So This was not an issue amongst the Amish. One thing that when we talk about occupation, and I know we're only down to just several minutes remaining, and as I'm mentioning, the number of Amish dairy farms has decreased. And even during the period when the number of Amish dairy farms was increasing up through April of 2018, the proportion of Amish households that were engaged in dairying was slowly decreasing. The Amish are increasingly finding that there are certain other occupations they can become involved with, which may be actually more lucrative than dairy farming. In particular, we see in some communities that a very sizable proportion of the households are engaged in woodworking.
Mm-hmm.
And this ranges from both involvement in having their own sawmills, which are particularly common, for example, within the Augusta Amish community in Eau Claire County, but to take the wood, convert it to everything from flooring, to pallets, to a wide variety of wooden products.
And you also found greenhouses as well.
Well, not only greenhouses, but also a large amount of produce farming.
Uh-huh.
And the produce farming, yes, some of the items could come from a greenhouse, but many of the vegetables are widely desired. And the Amish have established their own produce auction houses where the produce is sold to representatives from local restaurants, groceries, a wide variety of groups who are buying, you know, amount more than the individual household would
buy.
Well,
John, thank you so much for joining us. We have to leave it there. John Cross, Professor Emeritus at UW Oshkosh. News update is next here in the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a poem about community.
Where we live and the relationships we nurture have a big impact on our lives. Writer R.S. Elias Barza shares a poem about the adventures and connections made in your neighborhood.
Las Chicas y Chicos de Blossom Street by Araceli Esparza. Door propped open with tree sticks, hanging out on Blossom Street with one-step stoops. Welcome to my street. I'm Luz, Luz Maria if you're formal. Our days are filled with family news, pretending and playing, and tiny jumps. The day goes by and we dash from one playtime to the next. Chicas y chicos are girl kids and boy kids and everyone in between. This is us. We're like little picture moments at sunset. I live with my grandma, me little sister Anna, a blind duck, and my tío. I like to hydrogarden, and I'm big on organic compost. They call me mija. Izzy, my best friend, is learning to do perfect cartwheels. And like the sunshine, she almost pokes my eye. Next door, stuck in their room with Wi-Fi, clicking a keyboard and swishing a finger pad, Junior doesn't fix mofles, he fixes code, night until day. Upstairs lives the twins, Paco y Pedro. Free time is dress-up time, and that's when Pedro wears pink. He banana smiles and drinks atole. Paco prefers green tacos and ham. When she wants to be like every boy neighbor, Anna plays the ultimate games and double dares us to race. She wins most of the time. With his empty cupboards, half-filled plates, our neighbor, Luis, comes over for grandma's tacos de jamón y pan. But on Sundays, he puts ketchup on his tamale. Best dressed with shiny white shoes and tapping toes, Beta has two puppies who swing her over puddles and carry her to pick the blooming lilacs across the street. Con los vecinos, our neighbors, we learn to ride our bikes in the parking lot. Together we have a cookout and be like family. None of us are related. Still, we talk, argue, and laugh like familia. Okay, let's race, Beta says. And her dress flutters against the wind. Anna, with holy toe shoes, makes up for time jumping over onion beds, while Mago speeds up and stops short at the corner. Her arms are ready for the Olympics. No one told her she couldn't walk. They told her she could fly. My friend Izzy gets stuck on Saturday morning meetings at the local Centro Comunitario, a stand-up-for-your-rights mommy equals tag-along girl kid. When she comes home, Izzy skips upstairs, finds her friends to compare drawings on tablets. The twins' place is always busy with parties, viernes de quinceañera, sábados de cumpleaños, y domingos de virgencita. Paco y Pedro wonder when all the cheek pinching will ever end. Four cheeks aren't enough. In the next building over, Juan, his three brothers and one sister, sleep tight as pea pods in one room they call theirs. In their dreams, they can be anyone. He asks me, when will the beans come up? Soon, very soon, I show him. Through the city's dusty roads, fresh air smells break through. Against the orange sunset, I step off my Tio's troca and I am home. I smile at my garden. For me, all of them are my friends. We have aventuras, vidas, y laughter. Somos los de Blossom Street. We are from Blossom Street.
That was writer Araceli Esparza. PBS Wisconsin has created animation for her poem, Las Chicas y Chicos de Blossom Street. Head over to wisconsinlife.org to see it come to life. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
And now to Chippewa County, which has experienced a massive surge in methamphetamine use over the past 4 years, spending more on drug-related health care than any other county in Wisconsin. The statistics come from its campaign called Stand Against Meth. How has meth affected your life or your loved ones? Are you struggling with addiction and seeking help? Join in your story, 800-642-1234. Rose Beyer is Criminal Justice Services Director for Chippewa County and coordinates the Stand Against Meth campaign. Rose, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you very much for having me today.
Well, explain the problem. How severe of a problem is meth in Chippewa County?
Sure. Well, we know not only in Chippewa County, but all over the state, and especially in the northern region, it's crippling families, leaving our service providers and criminal justice system really grasping for resources and interventions. In Chippewa County, we've been tracking the effects of meth since about 2014-15, and we've noticed very staggering increases in the meth epidemic in our area. It's inundating our jails, it's limiting our foster home resources, and it's really having an impact overall our county budget, not just in the criminal justice area.
Methamphetamine, a powerful, highly addictive stimulant drug affecting the central nervous system. Where is the meth coming from?
Well, from what I've learned from law enforcement and other trainings that I've been participating in, it's now coming, they believe, from the southern borders in the United States, coming up into the metropolitan areas such as Minnesota. I believe Chippewa County and the surrounding counties in my area are seeing such inundation because of the major highways that we have going through our towns from bigger metropolitan cities such as Minneapolis. Years ago, we used to have meth labs in the county and one pot labs, but since the government has put stipulations on over-the-counter medications and things to make the methamphetamine, it seems like we don't see those as often as it coming in from out of area.
Yeah, you know, some of the chemicals used to produce meth are like chemical drain cleaners and antifreeze, paint thinners, and these over-the-counter cold medicines. Has your county considered ways to make it harder to get these items?
I think it really has been made harder just legislatively, throughout the entire state to get some of these items. There are checks with driver's licenses, or you have to sign out certain types of these items now, I believe, in many of the areas in Wisconsin.
How has the meth crisis infiltrated your community? You mentioned jails and foster care. How has it really invaded, families and workplaces, business and industry and public spaces?
Sure. I think it's invaded all of those. And I'm sure it's not just a problem right here in Chippewa Falls, or Chippewa County. We are really having a hard time business-wise with getting people who are employable and it's not just because of COVID, but because of the methamphetamine epidemic. We're also seeing our foster home care rates, just to give you an idea, just to picture what that looks like. In 2014, we had 12 kids in out-of-home care for child protection services due to meth-related incidents. In 2020, that was 185 kids. So
Wow. We're
really looking at that type of data across the board. Our district attorney cases that they process, our public health kids with special care needs. And that's what we're using to gauge part of that meth epidemic that's happening in our area.
What is the impact on homelessness?
We are seeing more homelessness. Chippewa County is a rural, Eau Claire is right next to us. It's a little bit larger population, and I know homelessness has increased there, but we are seeing it as well. People that are even coming into our jail that don't have a place to live, that are homeless, that are being released back out. I don't have the exact numbers for you for that, but I can tell you that we are noticing, especially in my field.
You are Criminal Justice Services Director. What does your job entail, and how does it relate to this meth problem?
Sure. So as the Criminal Justice Services Director, I oversee our recovery court, which a lot of counties call drug court. It's a treatment court. I oversee all of our front-end intervention and treatment programs and adult diversion programs. I also work with our jail programming and our drug testing. And then I coordinate what we call our Criminal Justice Collaborating Council, which is a council made up of all the top decision makers in the criminal justice system, as well as coordinate the Take a Stand Against Meth campaign. So it really goes hand in hand with what I see every single day in regard to treatment and services and intervention, and what we're trying to do with the campaign, which is prevention, education, and intervention.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the campaign in a moment, but are the diversion aspects for adult diversion and the treatment services, is there enough?
No, I would say there's never enough. We really, part of our ask for the campaign and part of what we've been getting back from the community around the treatment aspect of it, especially before becoming involved in the criminal justice system, there just isn't enough access to it. It's getting better. I believe the legislation with allowing medical assistance to pay for residential treatment is now helping a little bit, but there's just not enough treatment providers out there and long enough residential treatment. And then the transition from treatment for individuals is also a struggle.
And treatment close to home, that too has been a struggle for families. And I would imagine in rural areas, yeah.
I'm sorry, we are fortunate here that we do have a few residential placement providers right within our area or our vicinity. But for a lot of the rural northern counties, it's just doesn't exist, and they have to go extremely far from home for that.
You know, Rose, the opioid epidemic and the addiction to prescription painkillers, that has been so front and center. How does that compare to what you're seeing with meth?
Well, I think the opioid addiction has gotten a lot of publicity, a lot of attention. I think with the opioid addiction, you're looking at more fatality and overdoses with that addiction, and also the ability for medical assisted treatment. So I think it has gotten more attention, although I think the meth has become almost, especially in the northern area, almost as you know, I'm trying to find my word here, but people are overdosing now because of meth, because the drugs are laced with other drugs like fentanyl. Mm. Some people are taking meth and heroin, for instance. So I think we're seeing more of that now. And I do believe that the state and the legislature is really starting to become more aware. Our legislators recently invited us down to speak with the Assembly on Substance Abuse and Prevention about the campaign and what's going on here in our county.
Yeah, a compounding problem. Rose Beyer, coordinator of the Stand Against Meth campaign in Chippewa County, grassroots community effort to address the drug crisis. Is your community ravaged by meth? How has it affected your residents? Do you work in healthcare or in a social service agency role? What can you say about meth use in the patient or clients you work with? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about how Chippewa County has been hit hard with meth use. Here is the voice of Tom, a recovering user from a Stand Against Meth documentary.
I chalked up my overdoses as mismanagement, not as brushing with death. I just disconnected myself with it, so I didn't have to face what was really going on.
Is your loved one battling drug addiction? What resources have helped? What can counties do? Still time, 800-642-1234. Rose Beyer, Criminal Justice Service Director in Chippewa County, with us for about 9 more minutes. Rose, we just heard from Tom there, who shared his experience with meth addiction. How difficult is it to treat meth?
Well, I think it's very difficult. Like I talked or alluded to before, there really isn't any medical assisted treatment to help curb those cravings with meth and help people to gradually get off of the meth, such as with the opioids. Individuals actually say the physical withdrawal, when I've talked to them, from meth is a little bit easier, but that the cravings last longer and it's really hard to kick the habit.
What has happened in the pandemic with meth use?
Gosh, in the pandemic, we've just seen a lot of people in our programs, our recovery court, our diversion and treatment programs, relapsing. I think people are stuck at home, isolated, and usage has probably increased. It's hard to tell. I think it's going to catch up with us now because there wasn't an ability for law enforcement to be stopping vehicles and doing things that they normally would do during the pandemic when things were shut down. Mm-hmm. But now we have seen that really catch up. Looking at numbers, and just from January to May with one of our local police departments, to give you an idea, number-wise, in 2017, they had recovered 78.5 grams of methamphetamine in their area, Chippewa Falls. And in 2021, in that same amount of time, they had recovered 342 grams of methamphetamine. So
huge increase.
It's huge. It's huge. And it's only, even with all of the things that we're trying to do to help decrease and prevent it, it still is there.
Your Stand Against Meth campaign and this curriculum you've developed for schools, really trying to talk with young people and teens about what is going on. Can you explain what you're trying to convey?
Definitely. So with the campaign, we're really trying to do prevention and address adverse childhood experiences with youth. Adverse childhood experiences are abuse, neglect, or household dysfunction that someone might have growing up, and they get an ACE score. So a lot of these kids that we're seeing, these youth, have really high ACE scores, which will lead to the probability of increased physical and mental health and behavioral issues as adults. So we're trying to not only address those in the youth, but also prevent and educate, provide prevention and education, and also get them involved in the community events that are positive.
What have those events been like? What is that community outreach like?
Sure. So with the Take a Stand Against Meth campaign, we really started with trying to get all of the community involved and building task force teams in the community around business, health and wellness, service organizations, faith, education, and law enforcement areas, thinking that would encompass all individuals that want to be involved. A few of our groups and our core team have come up with action plans based on community feedback. We had community town hall meetings, and they told us what they wanted and what they thought we needed and needed areas or suggestions. So one of those was involved around community outreach and the youth. So we developed in partnership with CISA-10 a curriculum that is specifically related to meth that can be used in kindergarten through eighth grade. Although schools have curriculum and AODA curriculum, a lot of it doesn't focus specifically on meth, which is significantly addictive. So we created this Not Even Once curriculum that will be rolled out hopefully soon to all of our school jurisdictions if they want to use it.
We're talking with Rose Beyer, the Criminal Justice Services Director for Chippewa County, coordinator for the Stand Against Meth campaign. As we've been talking about, you can join in. What questions do you have about meth? What do you want to know about the drug's effects? What do you want to know about treatment options or what your community has done? 800-642-1234. Angela is joining us from Baraboo. Angela, hi. What is your perspective?
Hi, I am calling because back when I was in college, I took a psychology course, and it consistently, what it seemed to say was that in order to pick up a good habit or get rid of a bad habit, any type of addiction, what you needed was a consistent 90 days of treatment, and you needed to be taken out of the environment in which the habit started. And with insurance companies, you'll get 30 days of rehab. and then boom, you get dropped right back into the same place where you were doing meth or heroin or whatever bad habit you had before. And I just kind of feel like unless we change that, we're setting people up for failure.
Rose, your thoughts?
I completely agree with you, Angela. It is one of the necessary items, and it's one of our legislative asks with the campaign is the longer treatment. You need to have that longer treatment. Even when you stop using meth, it takes up to a year for your levels and your dopamine levels, those chemical balances to straighten out. And we're really seeing if we put people in treatment for 30 days and they're going back to that same environment and don't have a sober housing or sober living arrangement, they're relapsing and it's not successful.
Angela, thanks for the call. So when you talk about your legislative asks and you address lawmakers at the Capitol, what does Chippewa County need? Where are the solutions?
Sure. I think those really fall around the treatment, the intervention pieces with the transitional housing, with the longer term ability to be in residential treatment. Those are the really big two things that we are focusing on. Chippewa County, we do not have ability. We have sober housing for my programs, a three-bedroom house, but we don't have any transitional sober housing or transitional programs outside of residential that are long-term, that can help somebody longer-term, like up to a year, put what they've learned in residential treatment into practice.
Yeah, so that transitional housing you see as is a real key here, that there's not enough of it.
Yes, I completely see that here, especially for people re-entering our jails, which a majority of our individuals in jail do have, probably 90% of them have some type of addiction or mental health issue. So especially for those individuals who are re-entering into the community and have no place to go back to that's appropriate or safe.
I wonder, as federal pandemic aid trickles down to county governments, could some of these funds be put toward fighting the meth problem?
I think they possibly could. I'm hoping that happens. I know in our county, some of those aids are being looked at right now. There hasn't been a decision, but our core group of administrators is really looking at options and what can be a long-term benefit for applying those funds.
Circling back to the Stand Against Meth campaign, what is the next stage of this campaign? Where are you taking it?
Well, right now we're currently recruiting actively volunteers. The core team has ranked and prioritized all of the feedback that we've gotten from the community, which is about probably 13, 20 items. And we're focusing on three areas right now. The biggest one was the creating reporting opportunities for an education for the community. So we're trying to implement a Crime Stopper program in the community, but I need community board members and help from all of our community to get this up and running. The other two areas of focus are the faith and service organization involvement and education and buy-in from businesses and landlords related to people with addiction or who are in recovery, getting the faith and service more involved with foster care recruitment.
Yes, a lot of work to do. Rose, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Rose Beyer, coordinator of the Stand Against Meth campaign and Criminal Justice Services Director for Chippewa County. We have a link to the campaign at wpr.org/mornings. This is the Ideas Network.